the Netflix one. Did you guys watch that? It's like the end of the world or something.
Not the zombie one.
This is another apocalyptic dystopian.
I'm sure I saw it. I see everything.
I've just been watching old John Grisham movies. <It's so good.
laughs> Lawyers in old state houses or courtrooms in Mississippi.
Leave the World Behind. That's a good one too, Carol.
I haven't seen that one yet.
It's on Netflix. It's good.
Yep, I'm in that kind of mood. This is Behind the Lens, a podcast from The Lens, New Orleans' first nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest newsroom dedicated to unique, investigative, and explanatory journalism. I'm Carolyn Heldman. On this week's episode, proposed state legislation could mean the loss of food stamp benefits for thousands of residents, and oil giant Exxon was planning on injecting tons of carbon dioxide into the ground in Louisiana, but good luck finding out where the sites are located. Those stories, insight, and analysis coming up on Behind the Lens. Joining us this week, criminal justice reporter Nick Krastel. Hey, Nick.
Hi, Carolyn.
Investigative climate reporter and Lens contributor Sarah Sneath. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
And deputy editor of The Lens, Marta Jusen. Hi, Marta.
Hey, Carolyn.
Okay, Nick, we're going to start with you. For years, there's been a federal law requiring able-bodied food stamp recipients without dependents to work in order to receive food stamp benefits. But for decades, Louisiana has routinely asked the feds to waive the requirements in areas where unemployment is high and jobs are scarce, which covers a lot of the state, most of the state. That waiver may end soon under new proposed legislation. What's happening there?
Yeah, so a proposed state law would prohibit the Department of Children and Family Services, which administers SNAP benefits or food stamp benefits across the state, from applying for these waivers. As you said, these waivers waive the food stamp work requirement for able-bodied adults without dependents. These are federal work requirements that require someone work at least 80 hours a month in order to receive SNAP benefits. You can receive SNAP benefits for 3 months in a 3-year period without meeting those requirements. But once you've hit that limit, then you're kicked off if you don't provide proof that you're working at least 80 hours a month. So like you said, the state has routinely applied for waivers to this requirement, and federal law allows you to apply for these waivers if unemployment is at a certain level in a parish or across the state. It has to be, you know, above the national average for unemployment, or if you can show that jobs are scarce in a particular area. So for many years, the whole state has been exempt. And during the pandemic, these rules were waived across the country. And so currently about half of the state is exempt under these waivers. These waivers were applied for under the previous governor's administration. So, you know, like I said, 33 parishes are now waived from these work requirements. This new law would prevent the state from applying for them at all. So the whole state would be subject to these work requirements, regardless of the unemployment rate.
Okay. Who's behind this legislation?
Senator Blake Miguez, a Republican out of New Iberia. And also, you know, presenting on the bill was someone from the Foundation for Governmental Accountability, which is a big national conservative organization that kind of has pushed for similar laws, along with lots of other conservative policies around the country. So they seem to be somewhat involved in this as well.
And their motive is that we should push people to work because work, there's a quote you have, work provides lasting value we can give back to our families, our community, and God.
Yeah, the general, I think, perspective from Senator Miguez and the people in support of this bill is that there is a contingent of people who are able-bodied, perfectly willing to work, I mean, perfectly able to work, have no real, wouldn't have any problem finding a job, but have become dependent on the food stamp benefits and have chosen to not get a job and instead, you know, stay at home and enjoy, you know, food stamps. They point to a study in Florida that shows that when Florida passed a similar law and got rid of these waivers for work requirements, and the food stamp rolls went down considerably. A lot of people went off food stamps, and they kind of show this and say, look at all these people that went back to work. In fact, this study does not show how many of these people went back to work. It shows how many people were you know, were moved off of food stamps. Some did go to work, as, you know, many people, whether or not they are subject to these work requirements, would. But I think that, yeah, like I said, the general philosophy is that there's a large portion of people who are just relying on these food stamps. You know, it should be noted the maximum amount a single individual could receive for food stamps is under $10 a day. So even in Louisiana, where minimum wage is the lowest it can be, it's the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. You're basically making, you know, about an hour of work, you know, a day on food stamps. It's not a huge amount of money, and
right,
certainly not enough to live off of. And most people who are on food stamps do work. So, you know, people who are opposed to this bill and actually opposed to the federal work requirements in general, you know, just, I think, generally object to the idea that there's lots of people who are willing, who don't want to work and are staying home collecting these benefits. Instead, they, you know, point to real kind of obstacles to employment, a lot of rural areas where it can be hard to find jobs, transportation issues, you know, people who are formerly incarcerated who have trouble getting hired, and also point to kind of this administrative burden that these requirements place on people. So if you're working a service industry job, for example, and normally you work 25 hours a week and do meet the work requirements, but, you know, 1 month the shift is cut, and so now you're working 18 hours a week, you have to inform DCFS of this change. If your hours go back up and you don't inform them or they don't register the change, you could have another month logged against you where you're not meeting the work requirements, even if you maybe are, and, you know, could lose benefits because of that. So I think there's a number of complicating factors that people opposed to these work requirements would say, you know, this idea that there's just people who don't want to work isn't giving the full picture.
It just kind of feels like that cost benefit analysis isn't quite fully there between the people who are advocating for work requirements and kind of this work ethic bootstrap mindset, where if you are adding these hours in, and like you said, you have additional transportation costs, you're paying for car insurance, you're in a rural area, or all of a sudden you're working X hours a week or X more hours per week, but now you have to pay for X hours of childcare.
Right.
Like, where is the cost benefit there for a family? And then, you know, a lot of times I think the same people who are kind of pushing this are, you know, how do you say, like a kind of family first driven. So sometimes I feel like those things are kind of in conflict, and it's surprising to me.
Well, this is, I mean, it should be, these are people who don't claim dependents. So ostensibly they're, you know, single individuals, not with childcare needs. And that's one of the arguments that they make is, you know, by not giving benefits to these people who they believe don't actually need them, there'll be more for people who actually do need them. In reality, it's not a zero-sum game like that. You know, the people with dependents and people with disabilities aren't going to receive more in SNAP benefits because we aren't going to be providing them for able-bodied people without dependents if they don't meet a work requirement. They'll still be getting them. The idea that it's kind of one or the other, I think, is a little bit misleading.
Mm. And there are plenty of people who care for children that they don't get to claim on their tax forms. And, you know, this is not even considering like the cost of, or separately, able-bodied person with no kids, you know, car insurance is insane. So.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
Yeah, and I think the definition also, you know, whether or not someone is able-bodied and kind of how the administration assesses that, I think is also a concern for people. It's, you know, not always clear if you're just filling out a form or talking to a, you know, a caseworker, whether or not this person should be considered able-bodied or whether or not they have, you know, some disabilities or reasons that could prevent them from finding employment or keeping employment.
Hmm. This is not a surprise because we are under a new administration, a new governor who's a Republican, and he's been revealing his hand. And it, you know, it's unsurprising because we knew who he was based on how he was the attorney general and how he what his priorities were in that office. But we're slowly sort of chipping away at a lot of the social safety net. There was one that caught my eye in your story about school lunches over the summer and that program that they declined to take $70 million plus from the federal government to support that. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was kind of one of the most public instances so far where the governor has kind of indicated where he stands on these social safety net programs. And he declined a summer EBT program, a federal program that, yeah, would have provided $70 million or $70 million plus in free lunches for kids throughout the summer, and declined to take it. And, you know, I think the quote at the time from the DCFS secretary was that, you know, he called the EBT program piecemeal program that comes with more strings than long-term solutions.
What could that possibly mean?
I think, as we kind of talked about, I think it's a general philosophy that these programs somehow keep people in poverty by not incentivizing them to work. You know, of course, these meals are for kids, so you could argue that those incentives maybe don't quite make sense, but that's their position. And, you know, there's been pushback from even Republicans in the state legislature, and there's a bill that would require DCFS to take this money. So it's not entirely clear how that's going to play out throughout the rest of the session, but it will be interesting to see. One thing I should note, though, about this specific waiver bill, this is something that the governor can do on his own. So the bill would codify a prohibition on DCFS ever asking for waivers. But the administration can just go ahead and not ask for these waivers and could not ask for them for the next, you know, however long Governor Landry is in office. So that's something that will be kind of interesting to see, is whether or not, you know, one, if this bill passes, whether or not the governor signs off on it. I think, you know, like we said, based on what we understand of his philosophy, it wouldn't be surprising if he did. Or if this bill doesn't pass, whether or not they go ahead and just don't apply for these waivers anyway.
And it is interesting with these administrations across the country to watch the rejection of federal dollars for these types of programs, we've seen, especially in the years since the pandemic, right? Federal aid was pouring into states to help mitigate those costs in every sector. And then, you know, now we're seeing rejection of federal monies at the most basic level to feed kids, right? And at the same time, we see Governor Landry advocating for, you know, subsidies to lift up crawfish industry because we had a freeze and that industry is suffering. So it's kind of hard to balance those two things next to each other when you see them happening.
Good point. Okay, Nick, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Behind the Lens. I'm Carolyn Heldman. My guests this week are criminal justice reporter Nick Krastel, investigative climate reporter and Lens contributor Sarah Sneath, and deputy editor and education reporter Marta Jusen.
Hi, I'm Ann Muller, Chief Operating Officer at The Lens. At The Lens, our mission is to educate, engage, and empower readers with information and analysis necessary for them to advocate for a more transparent and just governance that is accountable to the public. That means our stories are deeply reported and can take months to find the truth. As an advocate for openness, we provide readers with the source documents used in our reporting, inviting them to check and challenge our work, or to build on it through their own research. Support us in this mission by becoming a subscriber to our newsletter. You will hear about our stories first, learn about upcoming events, and we promise to not inundate you with emails. Sign up today at thelensnola.org/newsletter. Thank you.
Sarah, over 24 carbon capture projects are in the works in the state, but finding out where exactly they're planning these projects is proving difficult due to a state law passed in 2021 that allows companies to claim a wide range of project information as trade secrets. Tell us what's happening here.
Yeah, so I came across this story because of a former oil field site restoration commissioner. That's the commission in the state that handles abandoned and orphaned wells. And he was concerned that a well was plugged on Exxon's land in a favor for them because they were getting ready to launch this carbon capture project in the same area. And in order to kind of know if that was true or not, we needed to know the location of where Exxon was going to inject its CO2 underground. This is part of, carbon capture. That is the idea that you take industrial emissions, you strip them of the carbon dioxide, and then you pump the carbon dioxide underground somewhere. And so where is the question? Where were they trying to pump it underground? And when I talked to the Department of Energy and Natural Resources, they told me that they could not say where that was going to happen. So I did do a public records request, and I kind of was always one step behind Exxon in this because I found out they were going to inject the CO2 in some state-owned lands in Vermilion Parish. But by the time I found that out, they had moved their project to somewhere else. And then I was in the same situation where I didn't know, again, this new location because of the state law that says they can't get out the location.
They classify it as a trade secret. So you were, it was a bit whack-a-mole with finding out. And I'm not sure I should characterize this source as a whistleblower, but you did have some insight into what was happening through a former executive of not an oil and gas company, but what was Levy's?
David Levy. He was selected for the oil field site restoration committee, and he was selected because, yes, he is in the oil field. Yeah, so he's not a person who's against oil and gas production at all. That's not his philosophy. He's in the business. But he doesn't like the idea that a major company, oil company or otherwise, would be getting, what accounted to $900,000 from the state to plug this well. So he didn't like that. even though he's pro oil, he's not pro, corporations receiving state money. In such a generous way, potentially. And so he was kind of a bit of a whistleblower in that he's the one who honed down this one well. He knew it was on Exxon's property. And he thought there was something fishy about it because most of that $900,000 was actually spent cleaning up these big tanks that were blown about by a hurricane.
Yeah. So this is all so head scratching for me. Everything that some of what you wrote in the story is, I was sort of gobsmacked by the idea alone that the state would come in and these defunct idle plants, that are no longer, or wells that are no longer pumping, that the state is coming in and using state funds to clean up, to potentially prep them for a giant like Exxon to use for CCS projects. Is that right?
Orphan wells are a huge problem throughout the state and the region, right, Sarah? And there are like public health interests to making sure that there are not issues, but clearly in this case, that is potential to kind of take advantage of some resources there, right?
Yes, absolutely. I think the orphan well program in the state is funded by a tax on oil and gas production That is still public money because, you know, that means that once the state receives that money, it decides how to prioritize spending this money. And yes, Marta, like what you're alluding to is correct that some of these wells are very dangerous. They're leaking methane. That can be one situation that means that they're causing climate change, even though they're out of commission. And another issue is that they can, you know, potentially explode or something like that. And I think there was a child who got injured by one of these orphaned well sites in Louisiana. And that has kind of pushed folks to try to get the state to clean this up. And under the Inflation Reduction Act, there actually was money to help Louisiana clean up their orphaned wells. I think the pushback, though, is, you know, was this well really prioritized because of the safety, you know, and because of its climate change contributions? It didn't appear to be leaking methane, and it was in a pretty rural area on Exxon's property. So,
right.
You know, no one's, you know, probably going to be stumbling across that anytime soon. And then the second, you know, kind of situation is that Louisiana's own regulations are what kind of cause these orphaned wells, where when a company goes bankrupt, they can no longer be, you know, that well falls to the state as it's like the state's responsibility. So I think it's like that is a big question folks have too. Why is it that there's not a requirement that these companies set aside a certain amount of money to plug wells or, you know, clean up the mess that they leave behind? In this situation, the well on Exxon's land was actually left behind by Black Elk Energy, which went out in a terrible way. That company went out in a terrible way because in 2013, there was an explosion on one of their platforms offshore, and it killed 3 workers. And then the company folded after that. And that's how this well became orphaned.
Okay.
And it just so happened to be on Exxon's land.
So I just want to get back to my original question about this so I can understand how the process works for cleaning up these orphaned wells. The oil and gas companies are taxed, and then that goes into a fund that is used by the state to ameliorate anything that may be going on that is either a public health risk or is an issue for most residents of Louisiana, that would be the priority typically, that the funds are then drawn out as necessary. There's probably not, we can assume there's not enough money in that fund to clean up every orphaned well. So the prioritization is the question in this particular instance that you refer to in the story, because this one was didn't really pose a risk to anyone. It was sitting off by itself, minding its own business, but you know, orphaned and maybe polluting or whatever. But it got federal money, or it got state money anyway. And it turns out that may be because Exxon was planning to use it for a CCS project. That was really long, but did I get it right?
Yeah, I think you got it right. I mean, I think, you know, the other thing that was a bit suspicious about this is kind of like I mentioned before, the amount of money that was spent just to clean up those, to take the tanks and the cement off of the property, off of Exxon's property. So that money wasn't spent plugging that well, you know, that money was mostly spent removing trash and debris from Exxon's property. Another interesting thing is that most of these, the wells that are plugged by Louisiana's program don't cost nearly $1 million to clean up.
Mm.
It's a very large amount of money for the, you know, for one of these sites. Usually they cost closer to like $80,000 to clean up. So that's kind of part of what made David like questioning this one as well. As far as whether or not, I did not get proof, you know, that Exxon asked the state to clean up this site. You know, I did do a public records request for communications between the state and Exxon. And I didn't get in there like Exxon saying, hey, can you do this favor for us? And the state saying yes, you know, that was not in there. But it was interesting that it was interesting to see that the first time that this well came up in the records that I received was when the state was asking FEMA if they would potentially reimburse them if the state cleaned up the site. So I found that kind of interesting, you know, and it makes you wonder if there was a phone call or something saying, hey, we have these huge tanks that go up blown about, you know, is there any way you can do something about that? You know, again, I have no evidence of that, but it's just it makes you wonder, why did the state care that some big barrels got blown around on Exxon's property enough to be asking the federal government to help them pay to clean it up, you know?
Right. This is so confusing to me that a private company, multi-billion-dollar multinational company, would ask FEMA for help. I mean, any of these when after.
Well, in that case, you're saying the state asked FEMA, right?
The state actually asked FEMA.
Be normal for Exxon to ask them directly.
Yeah.
Like, that would happen in the course of action.
Yeah. So let me get backtrack again just a little bit. Levy resigned from this commission?
He did, yeah.
Okay. What's the status right now of all of these projects, of the CCS projects, the proposed?
Oh, the carbon capture projects. Yes. Uh-huh. So I think there are like 24 currently proposed in the state, and none of those projects have reached the point in permitting that they have had, you know, that they have public comments on them. So we don't know the location of any of these injection wells that they are, you know, planning to use to inject CO2 underground. This project, again, another kind of moment where I was kind of like just one step behind Exxon, it felt like, was that when I finally did figure out where they're likely to place the wells outside of the state property, Exxon all of a sudden pulled that, like sent an email to DENR saying, actually, we don't need those permits right now. Hmm. And so they put it on pause. They put the whole project on pause. They said that the reason was because they had just bought Denbury, like last year. Denbury is a carbon capture pipeline company that owns most of the carbon dioxide pipelines in Louisiana. And so Exxon purchased that, and they said that they were like looking at their, you know, kind of the new property that they own and if it makes sense to, or the new assets that they own. And you know, so allegedly, you know, so probably that means like they're looking at the pipelines that they own that they acquired through Denbury, and they're trying to figure out whether or not, you know, piping the CO2 to this area of Vermilion Parish still makes sense for them. Was kind of their reasoning.
Okay, I want to ask a probably naive question. At some point, these companies there's going to have to be a public comment proceeding or moment. So all will be revealed eventually. Why the cat and mouse now? I don't quite understand what they gain from this at this stage.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know either. You know, Exxon didn't tell me, and you know, no company told me how they benefited from this. I can say that the public commenting period is a limited time thing, right? They open up comments for 30 days. So you have 30 days now, whoever wants to look at the location of a site and whether it seems dangerous has exactly 30 days to do so, because they won't get that information prior to the 30 days.
Okay.
They'll get it as soon as the public comment period opens, and they don't have any longer to review it than that, you know? So I think that is like part of what is concerning about this, is that it gives people less time to evaluate a really technical thing. Also, I mean, that this is the location is the most striking example of how these companies are using trade secret to not give information about their projects. But there are other aspects too. Like, I have done a public records request for one of these projects before, and I got, or for a permitting application for one of these projects before, the state got primacy, and it was just page after page after page of redacted information. And this even had to do with the geology of the site, you know, of the project. So like, if you're trying to know whether this project's going to impact your groundwater, I mean, it's just going to be very, very difficult to understand, you know, to figure that out, because you're not getting a lot of information and you're getting only a short amount of time with the information that you do learn.
And that could be exactly the reason why, right there. You just summed it up, I think, probably just the time alone, just limiting the amount of time to gather information and an opposition. Marta.
Sarah, do you know how this compares to like other industry? Like, why are they getting, you know, trade secret kind of status and proprietary information for this specifically versus like other pipelines or things that would impact the environment and be, you know, in people's backyards?
Yeah. If they're drilling a regular oil and gas well, they have to tell folks where that is being drilled at. That is part of the permitting process for pretty much every other sort of kind of well that they'll drill, including a class 5 well, which is kind of like a test well for carbon capture projects. So that is kind of the loophole that we tried to nail down, was that if you know where the class 5 well is at, you're kind of going to know where the class 6 well is at, because they're not going to test in an area that's significantly geologically different than where they're going to actually inject the carbon. But still, I mean, they could, you know, there's nothing saying that they have to drill in the same site or use the same well bore. That's just kind of like a way to deduce where, you know, projects might be located.
And do you know class 5? Like, we know they've drilled in Lake Maurepas, right?
That's class 5. That's a class. Yeah, those are class 5 wells that they're drilling there. So, but if they change locations for the class 6 well, we wouldn't know that until the public commenting period.
This is still relatively, maybe untested is a bit strong, but it's new technology. It's on the vanguard. It hasn't been in use, widespread use for decades, right?
Yeah, I think that language is like tricky sometimes, right? Because I think that the probably most accurate way to describe it is unproven technology. It's not unproven though, because it hasn't been tried or because the technology is new. It's unproven and because the projects that do exist have not captured the amount of carbon that they set out to capture. Mm. It's not been utilized much because it's not been financially, it's not made any financial sense to do so. Under the Inflation Reduction Act, these companies are getting huge subsidies to do carbon capture. So that is kind of that's the impetus of all these projects we're seeing now, is the amount of federal subsidies available for these companies.
Okay. All right, Sarah, thank you. We'll keep watching and you keep on it. And we've got another story we want to talk to you about soon. So thanks for your work.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay.
Bye, guys.
See you.
See ya.
Bye. This is Behind the Lens, a podcast from The Lens, New Orleans' first nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest newsroom. I'm Carolyn Heldman. Thanks to our guest this week, criminal justice reporter Nick Krestel, investigative climate reporter and Lens contributor Sarah Sneath, and deputy editor and education reporter Marta Jusen. You can read all the week's other news plus opinions at our website, thelensnola.org. Thanks for listening.